Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This month, we're looking at vision standards and occupational eye testing. It's important to understand how tests are carried out and the implications of their results. Let's say, for example, one of your patients is a child but wants to become a pilot when they grow up. If it turns out that they have a colour vision deficiency, they might not be able to pursue their dream. For teenagers in particular who are preparing for adult life, this could have profound consequences. In this episode, we'll take a walk through some of the vision requirements for various different occupations. It's also important that optometrists know how to present the results of the vision tests that we do with clarity and compassion. Later on, Ian Trimmer, a social worker, will explain why realities about sight can be tough to accept for patients and their families.
What happens when someone hears bad news? It's likely to kick off their fight or flight response, i.e. their stress response. And when that happens, it's difficult for people to hear what you're saying. And they have even misinterpreted what you said that actually triggered that off.
Ian will explain how we can provide clear information and advice with a healthy dose of empathy and warmth. But first, to get an idea of how vision tests for particular occupations are carried out, I visited the Vision Research Centre at City St George's, University of London.
I have to speak slowly, because otherwise I may not be understood.
There, I met John Barber, a professor of optics and visual science. John and I discussed some of the traditional colour vision tests, the Ishihara test, often used for initial screening, the Farnsworth D15 test and the City University test, which was derived from the D15 to specifically identify protan, dutan and tritan deficiencies. But as you'll hear, none of these tests are perfect. That's why John has been instrumental in creating a new computer-based colour vision test called the Colour Assessment and Diagnosis, or CAD system, which is increasingly being used for occupational testing where accurate colour discrimination is essential.
Visually demanding occupations where vision can be safety critical, they all have vision standards and minimum requirements. And they're pretty well defined in terms of visual acuity, refractive error in terms of maximum refractive error with refractive surgery, in terms of binocular vision, stereopsis, and so on. And these are well established for aviation, for train drivers, for police officers, for firefighters.
So why are vision standards important for optometrists in everyday practice that aren't necessarily involved in occupational testing?
Well, some occupations are visually demanding, and some of the visual demanding tasks can also be safety critical. It is therefore important to ensure that those applicants who wish to work in some of these professions, they meet minimum requirements in terms of spatial vision, in terms of temporal vision, in terms of binocular vision, and also, in particular, colour vision. I think vision standards are indirectly important in relation to children, because many visual disabilities or unusual visual responses that are not immediately diagnosed as a very young child emerge gradually as the children go to school, etc. And it becomes important to be aware of these deficits or handicaps for two reasons. Firstly, in terms of choice of future career, but also being aware of the abnormalities that might be present at a very early stage is important in terms of changing the teaching and the approaches and enabling the students to cope with their education better than they would have done if they were just unaware of these disabilities.
So in practice, we can screen patients for a colour vision deficiency. Commonly what is used is either the Ishihara test or the City colour vision test. So for a person or a parent whose child has failed those screening tests, is it a case that they need to go for further testing if that's something that they want to do, or what's available out there at the moment?
The great majority of colour assessment protocols within occupations are based on Ishihara, with the exception of environments such as aviation or transport for London or Maritime Coast Guard Agency, where they also use more sensitive and also more accurate tests that provide a measure of the severity of colour vision loss. Now, the reason why this is such a problem is that a test like the Ishihara, for instance, fails many normal trichromats if one insists on zero errors on the first 13 or 17 plates of the 24
plate system. So what percentage of normal trichromats are likely to fail the Ishihara test?
Well, if you are to pass all the normal trichromats, you have to allow for 3 or 4 errors. And if you do that, then all the normal trichromats 100% pass. Right?
That's allowing for the errors.
That's allowing for those errors. But then only 1.7% of protons and 6.3% of deutons also pass.
Right.
And those who pass can be about 13 times worse in terms of red-green colour sensitivity when compared to young, healthy, normal trichromats. The City University test was designed to make sure that one would not stop applicants who had mild loss of red-green colour vision from pursuing their career desires, and is arranged so as to make sure that some colour deficient subjects pass. But if you really look at the outcome, if you allow up to 4 total errors so as to pass normal trichromats, then 55% of protons and 65% of deutons also pass. And those who pass can have severe loss of colour vision. In occupations, one also uses the D15. Where the subject's task is to arrange caps, minimally detectable perceptual differences. And what it turns out is that if you allow for 2 adjacent transpositions, so as to pass all the normals, mm-hmm. then what happens is 47% of protons pass and 56% of deutons pass. And those who pass can be as severe as 20 times worse than the healthy young normal trichromats.
So even with the Farnsworth D15 test, you're still going to get quite a high percentage of people who pass who have quite a severe defect. So what's the next level of testing?
Well, this is the problem, because you can insist on high sensitivity, but then the specificity is very poor because normal subjects fail. Or you allow for some errors, which means that normal subjects pass, but then you also pass some colour deficient. Mm. And this is the reason why one needs, let's say, a secondary test, which has both high sensitivity and specificity. And this is where our work for the Civil Aviation Authority and other organisations for the last 25 years comes in, because we have the colour vision screener and the colour assessment and diagnosis test. The CAD test. The screener is very quick and easy to carry out. The subject has to indicate whether they've seen something moving top right or top left. It's over in 2.5 minutes, and it passes all the normals, and it identifies virtually all subjects with congenital red-green deficiency.
So, John, you've mentioned the Civil Aviation Authority, but what other occupations or what other organisations use this secondary type of testing at the moment in the UK?
So we have the air traffic controllers, which employ, strictly speaking, just the CAD test. Then we have aviation commercial, which are pilots. It establishes whether your chromatic sensitivity is below the upper normal limit for your age.
Mm. And then what else do we have on crews that are affected?
The electrical industry, they were really quite surprised to see who they were actually passing with the current protocols. So as a result of it now, they allow subjects with minimal colour deficiency to become electricians and to work in the electrical industry field. And that is a great advantage. The inland waterways within UK and Europe, they also have a reasonably tolerant standard so as to allow those with minimum deficiencies to work within this environment. They are quite different to the Maritime Coast Guard Agency, which decides on standard for lookout officers on bigger ships, which require virtually normal red, green, and also a yellow-blue colour vision, because when one uses the CAD colour vision test, we are also tested for yellow-blue chromatic sensitivity.
And then the final one that I notice on the list there is the London Underground.
Yes, the London Underground, this is an important environment because it involves train drivers, and the most visually demanding conditions are the discrimination of signal lights, and they're within tunnels. And we find many subjects with a mild red-green colour deficiency now can become London Underground train drivers. And this has been going on for at least 15 years.
To get an idea of how this advanced way of assessing colour vision works, our producer Jason sat down in front of the CAD testing screen to have the rapid colour vision screening test carried out.
We are going to position you 1.4 metres in front of the display. We are going to carry out the colour vision screener test first so as to establish whether you really need to carry out the full CAD test, so as to establish the type of colour vision deficiency, which could be congenital red-green, acquired loss of colour vision, or congenital yellow-blue colour vision loss, which is very rare, and also equally important to establish the severity of colour vision loss. Now, the test is very easy to carry out. You'll be presented with a square of flickering checks, and then buried within that dynamic noise, you will have a coloured stimulus which moves top right or top left. And your task is very, very simple. Just press one of these two buttons that correspond to top right or top left movement.
Okay, it doesn't matter which colour it is, any colour.
It doesn't matter what colour it is, you just have to indicate if there's anything there and the direction of motion.
Okay, great.
So, for the next couple of minutes, Jason simply had to use a keypad to indicate the direction in which he saw a streak of colour travelling through a grey cube on the screen.
Quite nervous.
So, let's start with the screener.
Okay.
You have to press after you hear the beep. So press the button.
Okay. Oh, this is really hard. Can you see all of them, Michelle?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like that one, I had no idea.
The streaks of colour move fast. And if participants have a colour vision deficiency, they would find it hard to make out, say, a dim green streak against the dynamic flickering background.
Okay, so we have that one. And now you can see the result.
Okay.
So the test reports that you have congenital red-green deficiency, mm-hmm. and the confidence rating is high. The chance level is 50%, and you secured 52%.
Okay, right. That's quite bad.
And it says that you've got normal yellow-blue colour vision.
Yeah,
the confidence level is high. And most importantly, your reliability is excellent, 100%.
What does that mean?
It means that whenever you should have seen things, that you had other cues in addition to the colour, you performed 100% correct.
Okay.
So you're reliable.
That's good.
Okay, so what we would have to do now, in your case, there will only be probably 6% of all the applicants, and that assumes equal number of males and females applying for a particular job. Mm. What we would have to do is to carry on with the full CAD test.
Maybe you have to come back.
Maybe I have to come back, yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you very much, John.
Brilliant.
No,
thank you,
John.
So, a quick and easy colour vision screening test can have some quite significant implications on a patient's career prospects. I've sat down with my producer Jason to see how he's feeling after our visit to City University and as an optometrist, I've promised to offer him some advice. How are you, Jason?
I'm okay, thank you, Michelle. But I do have some questions for you. So has that poured cold water on my dream of becoming a pilot then?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't become a pilot, but it might restrict what type of pilot you become. So for some pilots or for some careers, you can have a full colour vision defect as long as you can still discriminate between certain types of colour.
Okay. What career prospects would it affect?
Yeah, so there are loads of careers that can potentially be affected by colour, but usually the context is laid out in any application process. If you were to apply to the police force, for example, you can have a colour vision defect. But if it's a severe defect, then they may be instructed or given advice on how to cope with that colour vision deficiency. But if they can't see any colour at all, so they literally only see things in shades of grey, then those people would be rejected from the application process. But that's actually quite rare. And then going on to careers like electrical engineering or even the fire service, where you wouldn't necessarily think it's that obvious that colour vision is important, they would go for further testing to see whether or not it impacted their ability to carry out their duties or their job role.
And I'm guessing something like a painter or decorator wouldn't be a great career prospect for me.
Well, you'd have to rely on someone else to tell you some information. So you may not be the best at judging what colour should be used, but if you're given a colour to use, I don't think that'd be a problem in you actually applying the colour.
Okay. So that's what I can't do. But is there any other aspect of vision that could affect my career choice?
So when we talk about vision standards, it doesn't just refer to colour vision. It talks about the actual visual acuity as well. And what's quite interesting, it's not just what you can see with correction, it's also what you can see without correction for some careers. So for example, if you are interested in applying to the police force or the fire service, they do specify a certain level of vision, both without any correction at all, as well as with correction. And that's because if anything were to happen where you can't wear your glasses or your contact lenses, for example, then you need to have a minimum level of vision in order to be considered safe enough to do that job.
Okay, so a slight problem here. I am also slightly myopic and I have to drive with glasses. Could I be a lorry driver or a taxi driver or do some sort of professional driving job?
For driving jobs, it's usually the corrected vision that's more important, but they do only allow a maximum level of correction. I can't quite remember exactly what the requirements were. So what I'm going to do just while you're here is I'm actually going to look up on the AOP website exactly what the HGV vision standards are, because I want to make sure I get it right for you.
Okay.
Okay, so lorry and bus drivers, group two.
So that's the AOP website is where you'd go for all this information.
Yeah, I would go. That would be my first point of call, because they used to produce a handbook, which I used to have a copy of in my consulting, so I used to be able to flick from page to page depending on what the patient required, but they have stopped issuing that. It's all online now. So you can actually just go to the AOP website and type in vision standards into the search and it'll come up with the different categories where they have that information. So it does say that lorry bus drivers must have a certain level of acuity of at least 6 over 7.5 in their better eye. And then it does say that glasses or contact lenses can be worn, but it does say that the spectacle power can't be more than plus 8.
That's quite a lot.
That's quite high, yes. So if you're just slightly myopic, you should be absolutely fine to be a taxi driver or a HGV driver. But when it comes to vision standards, it's not even just about the vision with or without glasses. There's also an element of the visual field as well. Because if someone has a restricted visual field, it can impair their ability to drive because they've lost some of their peripheral vision or they may have a dark spot in their vision.
So with the visual field requirements, would that also apply for my normal driving license, even if I wasn't doing a driving profession?
Yes. So if your visual field has been compromised, the DVLA can ask you to have your binocular visual field assessed to see if you're still safe to drive.
So I'd have to inform the DVLA of other eye conditions as well, right? It's not just visual field.
Well, there is a list on the DVLA website which specifies that the DVLA must be informed if you have things like diabetic retinopathy, glaucoma, blepharospasm, double vision, night blindness, for example. But then there's also a caveat that says that if the condition only affects one eye, but you have vision in both eyes, you only have to tell the DVLA if you do not meet the visual standards for driving. So that refers to being able to read a number plate at 20 metres away. and to make sure that you don't have any double vision. So people can find out more information from the DVLA website.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much for clearing all of that up, Michelle.
No problem.
It's been a bit heartbreaking to learn that there's lots of jobs I can't do, but I guess I'll just stick to making podcasts for now.
I think that's probably for the best, Jason. Now, as you've heard, breaking bad news is never easy for healthcare workers, and we could probably all use some tips for how to communicate more effectively in those situations. Luckily, someone who knows all about this is Ian Trimmer, a social worker who specialises in mastering difficult conversations, and he's here with me now. Thanks for joining me, Ian.
Hi, Michelle.
So why do we typically struggle with breaking bad news?
I think people often struggle with the kind of uncomfortable feelings that come up. We're told that we're social creatures, and there's this deep need to belong. And that deep need to belong actually comes from an even deeper need to feel secure. We need people around us to feel secure. There's an evolutionary reason for that. And breaking bad news has this potential to threaten that belonging, essentially. We also don't know how that person will respond, which naturally creates uncertainty, another thing we struggle with. If they act in a hostile way, many people aren't prepared to act and respond to that hostility. Many of us just don't want to upset someone. We like to affiliate ourselves with people. A lot of us like to be liked by people too. There's sort of those fears that come up. And another interesting one, I think, is that people aren't that comfortable taking responsibility. It brings a level of accountability, which I think can be scary for a lot of people.
Can we talk through an example in optometry? Let's say someone comes in and they really want to join the police force, but they don't have the level of vision that's required. How do you think an optometrist should deliver that information? What are your top tips for delivering this type of news?
Well, I think it starts way before you get to that point of breaking bad news, essentially. I've had numerous life-changing conversations with people, and the best outcomes have normally been when I've tried my best to make a connection with them, i.e. I've built some sort of relationship with them quite quickly from the get-go. There's quite a few different ways I kind of do that. One of the main ones is giving the impression of warmth, making that sure it comes through in your voice, in your body language, in your tone, speaking with that person with a level of enthusiasm, with them just wanting to be in your presence, a kindness, a friendliness, those types of things, really. And obviously, you have a level of professionalism along with that, too. So it's not over the top warmth, you know, go, hey, nice to see you. It's not that type of thing. But whatever you say needs to come from that place, if you like.
Yes, I think it's about being friendly and being approachable, because I think when patients feel comfortable, that's the first step, isn't it? When they feel comfortable in your presence, and then they start to trust what you're doing and what you're saying.
You hit the nail on the head. I think the warmth really helps with trust, absolutely from the get-go. And trust is something you need when you're going to have a difficult conversation and break some bad news, because you want them to trust what you're saying. The other broad principle I would suggest is something which is often referred to as perspective taken, i.e. you're trying to see the world as someone else sees it. But within that is a key component of empathy. So let's go back to this test, for example. They may come in looking quite nervous, and you notice that, okay? You've been able to see that, and maybe you know yourself what nervousness feels like. And then that's your cue really to help them feel more at ease. And funnily enough, warmth is one of those qualities that helps someone to feel at ease and building trust. When it comes to breaking that bad news, some people will display a range of emotions. So it might be anger, it might be disappointment, it might be denial, it might be shock, which is a normal reaction for some people to make. And you noticing that and also understanding that that's a normal reaction, along with not judging it, which is definitely a key component of empathy, allows you to build that connection with that person and have that conversation.
I can think of an example where I have come up with a situation and they don't want to believe it. They're almost in that state of shock and disbelief. Quite often I will explain to the patient what the standard is. So, for example, you need to be able to read this line on the vision chart, and you need to be able to read it with glasses or without glasses, whatever the standard is. And by showing them, they know that actually it's not just a case of me communicating it badly and maybe there's some wriggle room. They actually understand why they don't meet the standard, if that makes sense.
That's actually perfect, Michelle. So you kind of, when you're breaking bad news, if you can, try and prep them a little bit for that. And by you stating these are the standards that they kind of need to hit, you're kind of prepping them already, as opposed to if you told them all in one go, it's too much information. They feel overwhelmed by all that information. So that's fantastic. And then by pointing that out as well, like saying, this is the standard you hit and this is where you're at, that allows them to make that connection themselves. And it's always better for someone to come to that realization themselves when you're having these conversations. You know yourself, if any decisions that need to be made, if you've come to that decision yourself and you recognize that, then that makes it easier for you.
If a patient is still struggling to come to terms with the bad news, is there anything that we can do as practitioners? Is there any signposting that we can do, for example?
So what happens when someone hears bad news? It's likely to kick off their fight or flight response, i.e. their stress response. And when that happens, it's difficult for people to hear what you're saying. And they may have even misinterpreted what you said that actually triggered that off. So what you kind of really want to do is clarify if someone's actually heard what you've said correctly. So you may repeat it. You may say it in a different way. You may actually say out loud, I'm unsure if you've maybe picked that up correctly, whatever language you want to use. And then you maybe need to give them 30 seconds to a minute to absorb that information, because you want them in a position to then have that next conversation. And by checking in with them, maybe repeating it in a different way, you start to bring them back to the moment so they can hear things.
Because quite often when they've had time to process, they have additional questions.
Yes, we all do this. Whenever any of us struggle with some stress, our brains shut down to a degree. So by putting these things in place, making these suggestions, you're helping the patient to start to not just hear, but make the next choices that they need to make and process it.
And I find the other thing that really helps is putting myself in their shoes, if that's applicable, or imagining that that person is someone that I know and care about. So is that my best friend sitting there? Is that my sister? Is that my parent? Is that my grandparent? So particularly when you're trying to deliver something that's quite sensitive, I think having that thought process makes me more mindful as to how it's going to be received. And that helps me quite a lot.
I think that's a really good tip. It's a nice quick hack, isn't it? If I imagine that person is someone close to me, then that instantly changes that relationship. You don't have to do huge amounts. You just, oh, that person's that person I know. That's my mum, that's my dad, that's my friend. Right, how would I then respond?
Okay, that's great, Ian. Thank you very much for the conversation today. It's nice to hear your perspective on things and to realise that everybody's in the same boat when delivering bad news. None of us like to do it. We don't always do it well all of the time, but I think you've given us some great tips to improve what we do. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Don't forget that if you head to dockets.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. And by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering communication and clinical practice. We'll be back next month to look at corneal dystrophies, following on from Dockett's October webinar. So make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so you don't miss out. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.